Now, I realize it's fashionable in some circles to believe that no one in government should encourage others to read the Bible. That we're told that we'll violate the constitutional separation of church and state established by the Founding Fathers in the First Amendment. The First Amendment was not written to protect people and their laws from religious values. It was written to protect those values from government tyranny.
Welcome to Liberty Watch, an independent program on KVOI, Tucson's Voice of Freedom. This program is dedicated to the principle of eternal vigilance, which is necessary to maintain a free society. It promotes the free flow of information about government, technology, education, current events, and history, relying upon our steadfast Constitution to frame the informed consent of the Republic so that government forever remains servant, not master. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of KVOI, its sponsors, or guests. Liberty Watch is produced and hosted by Charles Heller. Any mistakes are his responsibility.
Welcome to Liberty Watch, where I have the pleasure of hosting some really wonderful people who write stuff that more of us ought to know about. And one of them today is Justin Dyer. He's a professor at of American politics at the University of Missouri, and he's the director of the Kinder Institute on Constitutional Democracy, which I want to get into and ask about in a little bit. His research spans the fields of American political development, political philosophy, and constitutional law. He is particularly interested in the interaction between the American political tradition and the perennial philosophy of natural law. Wow, is that a fit for Liberty Watch? Professor Dyer, welcome to the microphones and telephones of Liberty Watch.
Charles, thanks for having me today.
My pleasure. As I like to tell my guests, I'm glad you could be had. Yeah. Do you prefer to be addressed as Professor Dyer, Dr. Dyer? How do you like to be known?
You know, Justin is just fine for a Sunday morning.
Yeah, I agree with you, and it's for a guy with your kind of CV, it's humble. So, you know, personal question before we get into the topic. What bit you when you were young, what bit you to be interested in this topic?
You know, I tell you, it sounds like an odd thing to connect me to this, but it was reading C.S. Lewis. And when I was a high school student, I went to a public school outside of Kansas City, and I had a pretty modest assignment given to me by an English teacher, and it was to go to the library and check out any book and pull it down and read it. And the book that I pulled down that day was Mere Christianity. And a lot of people are familiar with this book. Mm-hmm. It was originally C.S. Lewis delivered a series of BBC broadcast talks during World War II. And the topic that he was given was to explain the tenets of Christian belief to a country that was theoretically Christian, but really no longer. Mm-hmm. And so Lewis took that as his task. But the interesting thing for me was that the very first chapter, and so his first talk, was just called The Law of Human Nature. And the basic point that he makes was that there's a real standard of right and wrong that exists, and that we know it by reason. And because we know it by reason, we can expect other people to know it too. And in the context of what he was doing, he's talking about Nazi Germany. And if we want to hold the Nazis blameworthy for what they're doing, it means that we think that they ought to have known better. And there's a really basic concept with a deep, deep history and philosophical undergirding behind it. And that's kind of what bit me. I was a junior in high school, and I got really interested in natural law. And then when I was an undergrad, I connected what Lewis was saying about natural law to what the American founders were saying about natural law in documents like the Declaration of Independence. And so that really kind of hooked me and pulled me in, and I wanted to know more about this whole tradition and how it influenced the trajectory of American politics.
Wow. Talk about a complete answer. If I could get everybody to do that in talk radio, how blessed a medium this would be. You know, I'm going to go zinging off on a direction that neither one of us had planned on, but
sure.
It's interesting if you listen to some of the interviews online of the late Justice Antonin Scalia. And it's an automatic response in the computer. Every time you say his name, it triggers that. There's a famous firearms designer that happens to, too, as well, who's originally from Utah, which now everybody knows who I'm talking about. But if I say it, the detector will get it, and we'll get a hallelujah chorus again. So, but anyway, when you listen to, I can stay serious, but only for short bursts. When you listen to the interviews of the late Justice, and he's asked about natural law, and one of his answers that actually absolutely stunned me was, he says, "I don't give a fig about natural law. I care about the text of the Constitution and us staying to what it originally meant." And I was shocked by that answer. Can you shed some light on it from your angle?
Sure. Well, there's a real division among conservatives about the philosophy of natural law. And a lot of what happened in the late 20th century in the conservative movement was that, as a reaction against what they took to be progressive justices who were going beyond the text of the Constitution and inventing new rights and expanding government powers, as a reaction against that, for I think a kind of strategic reason, conservatives decided that we really need to tether judges to the text of the Constitution and limit them in their interpretive capacities. So somebody like Scalia, I think, if you got him drinking a scotch late at night and asked him, "Do you believe that natural law exists?" he would say, "Yes, of course." He's a devout Catholic. His son was a priest. I think he would say the whole natural law tradition that the church affirms, you know, he would be all in on that too. Then if you asked him, "Do you have authority as a judge to spell out what that natural law is and to apply it in any particular case?" he'd say, "No, absolutely not. I don't have that authority. It's not given by the Constitution." Now, the real challenge, though, for somebody like Scalia, if you're an originalist, you care about what the founders intended when they wrote the text of the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. And what it meant at the time.
And what the words, the public meaning of those words at the time, what would somebody have understood them to mean? The challenge is, I think, that you can go back and demonstrate pretty well that, of course, the founders believed in natural law. And when they're writing, they, of course, the general public in reading these words wouldn't have had any idea that we could dispense with all this talk about nature. And so you do see this actually in a lot of the early Supreme Court cases. Justices like John Marshall and James Wilson and others are frequently talking about natural law and the law of nature and appealing to it in their cases. And so it's a challenge. It's an ongoing debate among conservatives actually about whether or not this has any place in jurisprudence. But the important part, I think, is that debate is really limited to judges. So how should judges do their job, and what authority does a judge have? And it doesn't really, for the most part, spill over to the question whether or not natural law is something that should guide our public life. I think for Scalia, he'd say, "Yeah, of course. If you're a legislator, you should, you know, think about right and wrong and reason about that and try to put that into policy. But if you're a judge, you simply stick with the text of what you get from the legislature or from the Constitution."
Hmm. Another personal question: does the response, what you say matters? Because you're a respected guy. You're very young. But you are, what your study is so deep, and you, the, how you keep straight in your head all the different things that you have quoted in the book you sent me, and part of the book you sent. I mean, maybe your motto is, "I can do all things through research assistance" or something. I don't know, but how you keep that, all those objects in orbit around your head is beyond me, but I digress. But does the responsibility weigh heavy on you to be careful in what you say, insofar as that in 20 or 30 years it may become the standard model for what we think, like did the words of Sanford Levinson in his Law Review article, that the embarrassing Second Amendment and Akil Amar and people like that who end up having their words quoted later on by various justices at the Supreme Court? Does that responsibility ever weigh on you?
It does. Not the idea that I'll be quoted at the Supreme Court, although I would be very happy if I was fortunate to have that happen. But I think about it in terms of being in the classroom. When I was a student going through, I had several professors who invested their time in my life, and they put reading lists in front of me and had me work through a reading list, and we talked about it. And the idea that I can sit down with students And I can put a series of articles or a series of books in front of them and have them read it and think about it and press them on it. That's a serious responsibility, and that's a powerful thing to be able to guide somebody in one direction or another. And it is tough because I'm constantly exploring new ideas and arguments and having these with colleagues and changing my mind about things. And so I don't have any, you know, any thought that I'm right about all of this. I mean, I'm working through it just like everybody else. And so that is a kind of danger to have something on paper written down that you're wrestling with yourself that comes back and can be used for all sorts of different reasons and purposes later.
Yeah, my father said before anyone knew my name, he says, never believe your own clippings.
No, that's exactly right. When you were mentioning that, as a side note, Sandy Levinson was one of my dissertation advisors on this project that you've been reading.
It is a small world, after all. Disney was right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's right. Interesting when I look in the book jackets of a lot of the authors I have on, like I have Stephen Hallbrook coming on next week. And, you know, I look at the book jackets of who reviews his work, and a lot of them have been guests on, well, I've been doing this almost 20 years now. I've been guests on Liberty Watch and America Armed and Free, people like Dave Hardy. I don't know if you know Dave or not. He's here in Tucson.
I don't.
David Koppel, who was co-counsel on Heller. And a lot of, it's interesting, you know, it's kind of fun to be able to touch a corner of jurisprudential history.
It is a small world, yeah.
It is. We're going to run into the break, but I want to ask real briefly if you can, and if you can't do it briefly, tell me. That takes more time than we have, Charles, and I'll put it after the break. But in the Prigg case in 1842, the Supreme Court ruled that Pennsylvania's laws against enforcing the Fugitive Slave Act violated the U.S. Constitution's Article 5, Section 2. Is Article 5 or Article 4? I think it might be Article 4.
Article 4.
That's a typo on my part. I thought so, because I thought that was an Article 4. I at least study this stuff.
A typo on my part.
It's probably me. If I had to guess between you making a mistake in the law and me, I'm going to guess it's me. Okay. Article 4, Section
we'll 2,
that a slave could be brought back across a state line. In that decision, Justice Joseph Story said that when the requirements of eternal justice come in tension with the law, it is the law to which the judges owe their loyalty, unquote. Do you hear people on the left screaming at this point?
You know, we don't that much, but it is a fascinating question about, and on the right as well, if you're a judge, and this gets into the question about Justice Scalia that we were talking about, if you're a judge and you're required to enforce the law, but yet you believe that there's a principle of eternal justice that's being violated by the law, what do you do exactly? And this is a perennial theme in American jurisprudence, and slavery particularly draws that out. And I know we're coming up against a break, and so we can talk about the various ways that happens with this issue.
Please make a note, because I'll go on to something else, and I have a caller in the queue. So please make a note on that and help me by reminding me of that, because I do want to circle back to it.
That case in particular is fascinating how it plays out.
Oh, and so too some of what Story wrote in 1818 is just fascinating that I learned from your book. I mean, I did geek out on it, I gotta tell you.
This is Herman Cain, and you're listening to Liberty Watch, so that government remains a servant, not master.
So they started killing each other for 30 years.
And what became the path to peace for them was that we can agree on how we govern ourselves. And the idea of self-government being the path to peace, I think, is very inspirational. And then we can be friends.
I wonder if they could apply that model to Chicago. Liberty Watch, an America armed and free, so that government remains servant, not master. Sundays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., right after Swap Shop.
Know what procedure is used when someone is accused. So fairness is not abused. Notice and trial, at least you must have notice and opportunity to present evidence, build your defense, an impartial hearing, accusers appearing. Do, 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 do. Process. Do, do.
Welcome back to the geekiest music and talk radio on Liberty Watch. We have the joy and pleasure of having with us Professor Justin Dyer. He is of the University of Missouri. And which university, which campus? Which
University of Missouri in Columbia.
Ah, right. Where the famous journalism school is.
Where the famous journalism school is, that's right.
Yeah, I applied to that.
and didn't end up going there.
Yeah, right,
so
yeah.
Where's your alma mater?
Oh, the College of Hard Knocks. I went to University of I didn't graduate from anywhere. I'm homo sans literis, man without letters. I did go to University of Illinois at DeKalb for a couple of years, and Pima College here for a year and a half. Various colleges and courses along the way, but no firm course of study. I got involved in the sales profession for many years, and that's kind of been my calling until radio came up, and it still is.
Oh, that's great.
I support my addiction to radio by selling it, even to this day. So, all right, we've got, hang on, caller, I'll be with you in a little bit, one in front of you, and let's see, we got Michael that wants to ask you a question, and I still want to circle back where we were before, but Michael,
sure.
You're live on Liberty Watch with Professor Justin Dyer of the University of Missouri at Columbia. Your comment or question?
Yes. While back, I was watching Fox News on a Saturday morning, and they had a couple of constitutional scholars who said that the Constitution needed to be amended to fit modern times. What do you say about that?
Well, I would say that we certainly have an amending process, and it's far better for us to go through the amending process, the Constitution, than to simply interpret our amendments through the judicial process. So I would say, sure, if there are things that we should do to amend the Constitution, then we should do that. And it's not the case, I think, that the founders or anybody else thought that it would never be amended or that we would never need to make changes. On the other hand, they did contemplate that frequent amendments would actually be a problematic thing because it weakens our attachment to and our veneration of the Constitution. So it should be treated as a document that we don't amend lightly, and we do for very serious reasons. But nonetheless, there's a process for that, and we should undertake that process if the institutions aren't operating in the way that they're designed to, or if things have changed such that we think there are some changes to be made. But my own take on this is that the basic underlying principles, that those remain the same, that those are good and they don't need amending, that the idea that we would separate government power, for example, that we would prevent the concentration of executive power, that we would limit people in terms of how many years they serve, all of that, I think, is good. And then the question is, do we need to tweak those institutions or the incentive structures to deal with the growth of the administrative state or the federal debt or whatever else it might be? And that's a conversation we should all have.
Michael, do you have a fast follow-up?
No, it's just I went on Facebook after I saw that segment, and I got an earful from a bunch of libertarians saying, how dare they suggest a situation like that to have the Constitution meet modern times.
Well, exactly what Professor Dyer just said. Michael, take your answer on the rest of it on the air, if you would. Exactly what Professor Dyer just talked about. There are some things that we could tweak, for exactly the things he brought up, balanced budget, and what was the other one you mentioned also?
Thinking about the administrative state,
oh, right.
I think in particular,
yeah.
Is there a way to continue to maintain or to reinvigorate the idea of separation of powers?
Right. I especially would love to see some type of constitutional amendment limiting the amount of employment, except possibly in time of declared war, to a percentage of the population in so that government doesn't metastasize. What we have is sickle cell government growth, which has led to a metastasis of government, like you call, but rightly so, more professorally, the administrative state. So all right. And
nobody thought it was a perfect document. They thought it was a good document, mm-hmm. and worth ratifying. But it's our job to think through whether it's working well and in what ways we should amend it. But it shouldn't be done lightly, and there's a process for that.
And certainly the founders, when you said they didn't do it lightly, but yet 4 years after the Constitution, they adopted 10 of 12 proposed amendments.
That's exactly right. So they didn't do it lightly, but part of the deal and part of the bargain going into the ratification debates was a kind of promise to turn around and make some very specific amendments that they had all talked about throughout that whole process of ratifying the document, and specifically to limit government power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all those first 10 amendments are all about protecting against what was seen as potential abuse of power.
Right, and especially not limiting the limitations such as in the Ninth and Tenth Amendments. But, you know,
right.
What's really historic about the Bill of Rights is that it's one of the first and last promises that government has ever kept.
Yep. You know, as a kind of a side conversation about that, there's a fascinating new book that I just read and reviewed for a journal. It's called How the Bill of Rights Became the Bill of Rights. I think the actual title is The Heart of the Constitution. And it's actually a fascinating book, and I learned a lot from it. But one thing that I learned was that James Madison never used the phrase the Bill of Rights to refer to those first 10 amendments that he had introduced in the first Congress.
What did he call
it? And that most, just the amendments to the Constitution. And it didn't fit exactly their view of what a Bill of Rights was. It came on at the end of the Constitution. It didn't have a large statement of philosophic principle. And so even on into the 19th century, a lot of people called the Declaration of Independence our Bill of Rights. And it really isn't until you get to the Civil War with John Bingham, who writes the 14th Amendment, that you start to have a conversation about the first 10 amendments themselves being the Bill of Rights.
Huh.
And exclusively the Bill of Rights. It's an interesting book, maybe a guest you could have on at some point.
Oh, I love it when people give me leads on the air. That's Gerard Maglioka, right? Maglioka.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, boy. Yes. he's next. yes. All right. To the phones. I want to respect the time of the callers. And Sean, you have a comment or question for Professor Dyer.
Of course, Professor. James Madison called it a limit on government, not a Bill of Rights for the people of the United States of America. Great job.
Right.
I appreciate that. Now, Charles, actually, he's one of the guys that believes in the court, but if the court actually believed in natural law, would we have the 1830 decision, I guess it would be North Carolina versus Mann, which said that slaves are property, 1857 Dred Scott, Plessy versus Ferguson, Wickard versus Filburn, which is basically an absolute degradation of the human right for a man to grow his own, I don't know, wheat and eat
right.
it,
yep.
eat it on his own. And then, of course, Charles knows this better than me, Harabayashi versus the United States of America.
That's
over
the
Executive Order 9066. I mean, the court cannot understand natural rights, Professor.
Okay, let's let him answer that, Sean, and then I will have you come back on for a follow-up. Does the court, that is, and it's an interesting challenge, does the court understand natural rights?
I'd say certainly the modern court does not. And as we're working backward, most of the modern decisions are not engaging in a kind of natural law framework as they approach cases. And Wickard versus Filburn is, I think, actually a great example of what the court started to do as they moved away from a natural law or natural rights jurisprudence. And so you see that in the New Deal era. You arguably see that with the internment cases that you had mentioned during World War II. You see that in Wickard versus Filburn, where you have a really astounding decision about somebody's ability to grow and consume wheat on their own property without taking it to market at all, and nonetheless being regulated in that. When you go back, and you had mentioned these cases about slavery in the 19th century, that was exactly the reason why I got interested in those cases. That we have, on the one hand, a country that's founded with a dedication to these principles of natural law, and Lincoln always in his rhetoric talked about how we were founded on these principles, dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. And we have that sitting in a really uneasy tension with the institution of slavery. And you have all those decisions that you're talking about. You have state versus man at the state level in North Carolina. You have these other decisions that I've written about, Prigg versus Pennsylvania, Dred Scott versus Sanford, that I think, and I think you're right, are clearly not engaging with or applying a natural law framework. It stands as a kind of rejection of natural law in the way that it comes down. And I think that's really, really interesting. And the nuance here that I would add is that a lot of those justices understood exactly what they were doing, that somehow slavery was the exception to the broader rule. And they carved out all sorts of exceptions for that institution. And it it distorted American politics in all sorts of ways leading up to and then even beyond the Civil War.
I think that Sean's mention of, and by the way, the cases you were thinking of was Korematsu, Fred Korematsu. Anyway, Korematsu, I think, warped the living daylights out of American jurisprudence. The idea that you could imprison American citizens without probable cause or with what the Declaration would call light and transient probable cause, that they might, just because they were ethnically Japanese, that you could incarcerate them on possible suspicion they might be saboteurs, I think just flies in the face of all that's holy in natural law, and number one. And number two is there are conservatives like Michelle Malkin who trumpet the Korematsu decisions. That was great. It was wonderful that we did it. It's like, you know, there's an expression in Spanish about that, I think, to trumpet the Korematsu decision is great. It's called the Vialochen Kopf, means a hole in the head, and it's the Yiddish version of Spanish. All right, stand by on...
This is Herman Cain, and you're listening to Liberty Watch, so that government remains a servant, not master.
It has never been government's job in this country to lead the people. It has always been the people's job to lead the government. It's a matter of biological fact, and that is your congressman does not have a spine. You must lend him your spine. We are a self-governing country. Your responsibility as a citizen is not limited to walking into a voting booth every few years and pulling a lever.
Liberty Watch and America Armed and Free, Sundays right after the Swap Shop.
And here's to you, Mr. Jefferson. We all miss you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mr. Madison. Heaven help these fools that legislate. Rights away.
Indeed, pray for those who don't know not to legislate our rights away. Once again, home of the geekiest bumper music on the radio. And with us is Professor Justin Dreyer. I'll get it right.
One of these times.
Exactly. You know, you get extra points for making fun of the host. So, And he's wonderful, written 5 books now?
Yes, I think 3 books and a couple of edited volumes and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And I realize now why the book you sent me was so informative and so deep and had so many new words in it. It was your doctoral thesis made into a book.
Submitted for graduate school purposes.
I could tell that was written by a PhD in this when he says to me, yeah, that was my doctoral thesis. Oh, no wonder it's written like that. I get it. You know, I don't normally, the works I read, although good, are not that thick. And that one was thick. All right. I want to go back to caller Sean, who has a follow up to his previous question. Sean, you're live on the air with Professor Justin Dreyer of the University of Missouri at Columbia. Your further comment or follow up, please.
And Professor, I mean the three that really it's Yasui, it's Harabayashi, and then Korematsu actually became the three big dogs in that Japanese internment case, which nowadays, of course, we would say, oh, those people are horribly different from us, and yet it rhymes with Nazi Germany. I mean, those three cases became laws against the nature of man that were all enforced by the Supreme Court. All three of them were absolutely against the nature of man. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. If you look back at the natural rights, routinely included among the natural rights that we have, it always included a right of motion, a right to move wherever you chose and wherever you wanted to. And so the idea that you would confine somebody and limit them in terms of where they can move was itself a deprivation of natural rights. And I think that the tradition would certainly see it so, and so that was what the Supreme Court was doing. It's not that that right couldn't be taken from you. It's that it had to be taken from you with good reasons, that you had to be convicted of a crime and you have all sorts of procedural protections and things, you know, you can confront witnesses against you and all of that And that was removed. It was simply a military order on the, you know, on the authority of the president to declare the whole West Coast a military zone and then to declare martial law and to exclude everyone from certain areas which confine them to military camps. And I think that was clearly a violation of natural rights. Justice Robert Jackson has a very famous dissenting opinion in that, and he was the one who went later to preside over the Nuremberg trials over the Nazis. And so there's a real connection there between what was going on and what we see later with respect to how we understood the Nazis and what was going on in World War II.
Mm-hmm. Was that Korematsu is one of the very, one of the few, if not the only that I know of, where the Supreme Court later actually apologized for its decision.
They've apologized, though I don't know in any official way have ever overturned the Korematsu decision, right? And so it is one of those, if you read the opinion and you read the reasoning behind it, it sounds like, of course, we have to have good reasons to intern people, but it doesn't sound as though that power has ever been taken off the table altogether for the executive branch. Was, at least, never been directly challenged.
Was that couched as an Article II power? Article II is the presidential, the president's powers. Was that couched as an Article II power under his war powers? Is that how they?
Yeah, that's right. I think as I'm trying to recall the case, right. it was an executive order,
right?
And the question was whether the president has that power, and it was specifically because of wartime power as commander in chief of the armed forces and the power then to carry out the war effort successfully, and it was done as a declaration of martial law on the West Coast and a delegation of that authority to the commander in charge of that area.
I wonder if the fact that it was a declared war has something to do with the legitimacy, according to the Supreme Court, vis-a-vis police actions, as was Korea, Vietnam, and any number of other 200 other conflicts that the United States has been involved in outside of the five times we've actually declared war.
You know, there was so many of the modern wars have occurred after, or they've all occurred after World War II, and so that's the last time we officially declare war. It's hard to know if the Supreme Court at that time would have looked at it any differently if it had simply been a police action. But we do have congressional authorization for a lot of the conflicts that we fight in
sure.
modern times,
well,
and the Supreme Court's treated those authorizations as the functional equivalent of a declaration of war.
Well, that's because it's done according to the War Powers Act. From 1973, mm-hmm. I think.
Right.
And because there is a so-called due process of law there, I think. At least that's my shirt-sleeve non-lawyer opinion of,
right.
of why it's.
Yeah, and so we do have, you have something that's not, it stops short of a declaration of war, and it's not a declaration of war against a sovereign country, but it is a legislative authorization of executive power in that area,
mm-hmm.
and really, in a breathtaking way, just a simple delegation of authority to the executive branch.
Mm-hmm.
And every president, you know, since Nixon, since the War Powers Resolution, has said that the War Powers Resolution is unconstitutional, but they would follow it anyway. But they,
right.
nonetheless, claim that power independent of anything Congress does.
Right. A shirt pocket veto, almost. All right. Sean,
yep.
One last follow-up.
The last thing, Professor, according to the NDAA, and I believe, and I'm probably throwing this out of my mm-hmm. back pocket, let's be careful about this, I think it was 2014,
yep.
the NDAA actually authorizes the executive branch to take anybody like me that would speak against the government and imprison them forever. Do you agree with that as natural law?
So I don't have the text in front of me, but I do recall during President Obama's administration, there was a Defense Authorization Act that did contain a provision in it that made it sound like, if you read it carefully, it made it sound like it authorized the president to indefinitely confine.
Detain, I think
U.S.
is the word.
Indefinitely detain, U.S. citizens who are found on U.S. soil, captured on U.S. soil. And so it extended the principle that we had been using for Guantanamo. And President Obama signed the bill and then issued a signing statement saying that he wouldn't use the power in that way, which seemed to underscore that the power was in the bill. We'd have to pull it up and find the language itself. But then to your question, would that be a violation of natural law? And I'd say absolutely.
Excellent.
Detention.
Thank you, Professor. That's all I wanted to hear right there. Thank you.
Yep.
Yeah. Great callers. And in fairness, he's also a host on this station as well. So let's see. Let's lock that one in. Let's hang up on that one. And I want to go back to the area where we were before. And we were talking about slavery. Seems juxtaposing the two seems almost, you know, like a clash of time. But going back to slavery, I was completely unaware that Roger Taney, who's the author of the Dred Scott decision and also Chief Justice, had spoken out against slavery as early as 1819. Mm-hmm. And he said, quote, until the time shall come and we can point to the language in the Declaration of Independence, every friend of humanity will seek to lighten the galling chain of slavery and better to his utmost, to utmost his power, the wretched condition of the slave, will seek to lighten the galling chain of slavery and better to his utmost, to the utmost of his power, the wretched condition of the slave, unquote. That was Roger Taney who wrote Dred Scott talking about how wretched slavery was. Can you give us some perspective of why a guy that thought that in 1819 wrote something that blacks weren't persons in 1857?
Sure, and it might be helpful even to go back a little bit and think of the broad sweep of how this comes together. We have in the United States, prior to the Revolution, 13 independent colonies that all have slavery, and it's part of the colonial heritage that they have. In the Declaration of Independence, there are principles that sound very much opposed to slavery. And I think everybody at the time recognized the way in which the principles that they professed cut against this institution that nonetheless existed. And so what do you do with that tension? You do have a real movement against slavery after the Revolution. Fairly soon afterward, at least half the states are either abolishing slavery altogether or adopting plans for gradual emancipation and gradual abolition. But by the time we get to the Constitution in 1787, you have a real division then among slaveholding and non-slaveholding states and a tension. But even at the time in 1776 and then fast forward to 1787 when they're writing the Constitution, nobody is really on the record arguing that slavery is good, that it's a good thing, that we should defend it and preserve it. At most, you get people who argue that it's a necessary evil, that there's no easy way to get rid of it, that we have to endure it for a time. Hold on just a second.
Sure, no problem. Life happens.
With the guy on the BBC when he has a child who runs into the room while he's on TV.
Oh, I hadn't.
It's
live radio. It's okay. Justin, we don't expect you to be in a sterile environment. And if your child runs into the room, it makes for better radio, I think.
So we're live together.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you have this argument that's going on, and the question is, what is the relationship between these founding principles and slavery? And almost everybody in the first couple decades after the Constitution all argued that slavery was against these principles, that we should, while slavery exists, we should try to lighten its load. We should try to get rid of it. And Roger Taney's arguing exactly this in a case in 1819 when he's a lawyer in Maryland. Now fast forward to 1857, and he's arguing in the Dred Scott decision. And he writes an opinion that says that the founders would have believed that the Declaration does not apply to Africans or their descendants, that they didn't include them among the people for whom the Constitution is written, that they have no rights which the white man is bound to respect, and he puts this into an official Supreme Court opinion. And so the question is, what exactly happens between 1819 and 1857? And one of the answers is that you have the development of this positive good defense of slavery starting in about 1830, that people stopped looking at it as a necessary evil. They started to argue that it was actually a positive good for American society, that we wanted to protect it, preserve it, defend it. And that all leads up to this conflict that eventually goes to the Civil War. But in 1857, Roger Taney has made a 180-degree change in terms of his arguments and how he sees this, and then how he retells the story of of American politics, leading from the founding to the day that he's writing that decision.
Slight turn here. Is there anything that you know of in federal law or in the United States Constitution that prohibits a state from leaving the Union?
No. So this is a challenge, or that authorizes either one, right?
Right.
So it's a theoretical question. You have independent colonies that decide to write a constitution together.
Mm-hmm.
The constitution is binding on them as states once they ratify. And so it takes a state to ratify in its state ratifying convention to become party to the constitution. Now, after it ratifies the constitution, it's binding on it, but the constitution itself makes no provision for how to get out of that or how to
right.
reverse that
and
decision.
The Tenth Amendment yeah. leaves the powers not delegated to the federal government nor prohibited to the states or the people themselves. So one would think
that
according to the Tenth Amendment, you can simply pull the ejection handle if that's what you want. If that's what the people
Yeah, so the question, it's a deep theoretical question, but it's who is party to the Constitution?
Right.
Is it the people as a whole, or are they states in a compact, and is there any way to exit? And in a kind of, that's a theoretical question with real practical implications. The issue that happens, you know, that leads into the Civil War.
Justin, we're up on a break.
Okay.
I'm really sorry to interrupt the brilliant answer.
No, let's get back to it.
Yeah, all right. AM 1030 KVOI, Cortero Tucson, the voice in the Perfection Auto Works Studios, 520-790-2040. One call holding, we'll get to you.
This is Dennis Weaver, and you're listening to Liberty Watch. You know, the exchange of ideas is so important to maintain our freedom in this country. And Liberty Watch is a show that promotes freedom, promotes liberty, and it's such an important show.
Starry, starry decisis, Supreme Court justices make the calls, based on facts pursued in 10 laws, to uphold man's rights in the Constitution. Impartiality, upholding and defending liberty, deciding on the constitutionality of the laws in this glorious land.
And welcome back to the lightning round, the last segment of Liberty Watch, and trying to find appropriate music for the guest, Professor Justin Dyer of University of Missouri at Columbia. Caller, hang on. We'll be with you in a moment. And you were finishing a point about...
So we're talking about the small topic
right.
of secession, a right to secession. And the practical way this came down for our own Civil War was the question about federal territories and federal forts and federal mails.
Mm-hmm.
And so if a state decides to secede, they issue a declaration of secession, declare themselves independent, and the federal government says, fine, we're going to continue to deliver the federal mail. We're going to continue to use federal highways. We're going to continue to have federal troops in federal forts and continue to enforce laws about the ports, all of that. Then you have two opposed options that are not reconcilable. And at the end of the day, it came down to a military contest about which side is going to prevail in that.
Right.
And so I think that the kind of practicalities of that in the present day would be something very, very similar in terms of, you know, who's willing to use force and what does that look like. At least Lincoln's understanding and his argument during the Civil War was that the Union itself was perpetual and that there was no right to secession, but rather there's a right to revolution, but only if revolution is justified.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a separate kind of question.
It
but
sure
there
is.
Would be no, it's a kind of theoretical distinction, but right. but an important one.
Right. All right. I don't want to go there right now. And we've got callers.
Yep.
And Mark, you have a question for Professor Dyer. Your comment or question, please.
Yes, it's two parts. And since the Trump administration, lower courts have been embattling the administration, the executive branch, on almost extending the constitutional rights to people who are not even in our country, who are not U.S. citizens, for example, the 5 to 7 countries that were held as not to be entering, people not to be entering in this country for a certain amount of time, extended amount of time. till background checks were fulfilled. And then the second part of that question is, the Constitution is somewhat ambiguous on who gets what kinds of rights if you're standing on U.S. soil. If you're, for example, an illegal border crosser, do they actually have U.S. Constitutional rights? And so that's the topic.
Okay. Let him answer. Justin?
Sure, two parts. So on the first part of the question, the Supreme Court did validate the president's authority to have that in our immigration law in terms of those countries you're talking about. And so there had been some other decisions to the lower courts. When it reached the Supreme Court, there was a validation of that authority. And it gets into a kind of nuance in terms of why those countries are chosen and what the motivation is. For the second question, in terms of who gets what rights, it is a challenge because the Constitution in some parts talks about persons and in other parts talks about citizens. And there's a question about what rights belong to persons as such and what rights belong to citizens as such. And I think there are basic rights that all persons would have. At the moment that you set foot in the country, you're protected from arbitrary assault and you have due process rights and you can't simply be arrested or detained or anything like that. On the other hand, there are certain rights that you have by virtue of citizenship. And those things would be more specific to your membership in the polity itself.
Right to keep and bear arms.
Political community.
Right to keep and bear arms would be one.
Right to keep and bear arms would be one. Certainly political rights like voting rights, for example, running for office. You have to be a citizen to run for various offices and a citizen for a specific period of time or citizen with respect to the president.
Not in San Francisco anymore, but.
Or maybe not at the state level. Sure, states could arrange things as they choose to. But that would be the distinction. So some things are going to be for persons, some for citizens. Now, the tricky question I think that we've wrestled with for a long time is the nature of the 14th Amendment's provision about birth citizenship.
Right.
That all
persons
born in the United States.
To the jurisdiction thereof. I don't think that grants birthright citizenship to illegal aliens born here.
So this is one of the big questions that people are talking about right now. What does it mean exactly to be born in the United States and subject to its jurisdiction?
Right.
And I think a kind of obvious exception to that would be children of ambassadors or something along those lines.
Right.
But it does present this really interesting question about parents' citizenship and the relationship then to the children who are born in U.S. soil and to what extent they're subject to its jurisdiction. And I think at least in some cases, from my perspective, obviously people would be, if they reside in the United States for a long period of time, citizenship or not, they're subject to its jurisdiction. But the tricky part that we're talking about is what if it's a very quick entry into the United States and how do we deal with those kinds of issues? But the courts, so far as I know, have always upheld this concept.
Pregnancy tourism,
the place of birth is itself what it means to be born and subject to the jurisdiction of the United States.
Okay, one last call real quick. Ingrid, you have a quick question for Professor Justin Dyer.
The Electoral College, in an attempt to get out from under the alliance between the monarchy and the church in Europe, the Electoral College was set up and almost seems to be an aristocracy whereby they could even override a general voter's desire. Would you agree? What do you think about that?
Take your answer
on the
air.
I think that the Electoral College certainly does allow the Electoral College itself to exercise independent judgment, that no elector is in any formal or legal sense obliged to vote for whomever the people voted for. And so in that sense, sure, the Electoral College could make a decision that runs counter to the wishes of the majority of the people. And in fact, as we've seen, we do have presidential elections in which somebody who doesn't receive a majority of the popular vote does nonetheless win the election. I think the reason for the Electoral College is actually a good one. The reason was partly to allow people to assemble in their states themselves on various days in the capitals of the states to cast their votes. And to try to insulate in some ways demagoguery, you know, and kind of the doomsday scenario of a national demagogue who wins support of the majority of the people, but nonetheless the Electoral College casts an independent vote and uses their own independent judgment, but it does have within it probably built in the potential for abuse, and it's something that we, every 4 years, we seem to wring our hands about and rethink whether we want to continue that system.
Justin, we're at the very stops right now. Would you give your website or any 10 seconds worth of information you have?
You know, I don't have a website, but I do have a program that I help direct at Missouri called the Kinder Institute, and it's democracy.missouri.edu, and you can check that out, and there's a bio for me and some links to writings and things like that.
All right, I have to let you go now, but have a blessed day, and I will reschedule you, and we'll do 2 hours.
That sounds great. I appreciate it. Thanks, Charles.
My pleasure. AM 1030, KVOI, Cortero, Tucson, The Voice.